We just wanna party.
Hi, everybody. This is Brad with the United Way of Columbia and Greene Counties. You are listening to WGXC ACRA, Columbia and Greene Counties, 90.7 on the dial.
Tune in or turn out Wednesday, May 26th from 7:30 p.m. to 11 p.m. at the Greenville Drive-In to WGXC's 10th anniversary drive-in event with performances from Brian DeWan from Catskill, Stephen Merritt of the Magnetic Fields, legendary radio artist Anna Friz, Lunar Moss, Jess Spear, Jeff Economy and Alana Medlek, Jen Cutler and Quentin Anna Wixwo, Mayuko Fujino, DJ Var, and Dan Seward from the Battlefield Earth Show, plus films from Charles and Ray Eames and Heath Iverson. Turn out to celebrate 10 years of community broadcasting on 90.7 FM at WGXC's 10th anniversary drive-in event. The Greenville Drive-In, Wednesday, May 26th from 7:30 p.m. to 11 p.m. Festivities get underway at sunset at 9 p.m. and can also be heard on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Bindlestiff Family Circus of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening. I'm Kevin Factor, and this is Foraging Ahead. Tonight on Foraging Ahead, if you don't know my guest tonight, you're dead to me. You're dead to me. Maybe you're from Long Island, too. Tim Davis is my guest. He is a poet, a musician, a singer-songwriter, a husband, a father, a humorist, a professor. He's a rapscallion, a provocateur, a creative dynamo, and a mensch. But he's best known probably as a photographer of some renown. And we talked about tonight his new book of photographs and essays called I'm Looking Through You by Aperture. So tonight, enjoy the quick wit, the deep thoughts, and the big heart, Tim Davis.
Being a photographer is like having amplification all the time, right? So you're just always attuned to the visual. And in this book in particular, I was like much more wide-ranging in my ability to render those things that I observed. So I was photographing in a much broader way than I had in the past. And all of it's really on foot as well. So it was like walking and looking.
So the name of the book is Looking Through You.
Nope.
No, that's right. I'm wrong. Tim Davis, I'm Looking Through You. Yeah.
Might be some graphic design problems there if you didn't notice that.
No, I think the cover...
That was my design, that part.
So. Is that right? I like... Could you talk a little bit about the book cover? It almost looks like a children's book.
Yes.
With the what do you call that?
Foil.
Foil and the multicolored lettering and the kind of a mustardy yellow. It's a very inviting book. Just looking at the cover, what were you thinking? What were you going for with the cover?
What the hell were you thinking? No, it's. I think it's an interesting question. This book is a book that you can judge by its cover. And I've noticed in the response to it that people are posting on social media and stuff just about the book, just looking at it. Mm-hmm. And that was a big part of my intent in the design phase. So we're cutting right to the design phase, which is usually would be maybe the last thing we would talk about, but I don't mind at all. In that, the pictures were made in Los Angeles where it's a beautiful day every day and it feels really good in your body. And the book and the photographs are largely about a kind of glorious kind of surface. And so as we started to edit this book, there were a lot of things that came into play, and it took 3 years to kind of put it together once the Aperture decided to do it. It took 3 years to actually edit, sequence, design it. And the one thing that the designer of the book kept sort of saying was, like, this needs to be something that you're just going to want to have to pick it up when you see it. Like, it just has to be a beautiful object. And the children's book side of it, I see, but it's also like a kind of, to me, it's like a kind of sublime that's also close to being kind of tacky. And this foil is, right, it's the kind of thing that is used in all kinds of products and packaging and... So that's foil that's inlaid into the lettering on the cover, and then on the spine of the book, it's this rainbowy foil. And the book itself is rather small in scale for a photography book. Most photography books are bigger, right?
Mm.
And I just began to think of this thing as the Tim Davis Bible. And it looks like a Bible. It's the size of a Bible, and its Bibles often have that gold foil.
Yeah.
So we're trying to get this one into every hotel room in America.
You're talking a little bit earlier about surfaces, and I love the opening essay where you get into the etymology of grammar and glamour.
Yeah, they're the same word. They're etymologically indistinguishable from each other. And so I'm interested in glamour. And we here in the Hudson Valley, you know, in the East Coast, we just don't have a lot of it. We don't have a lot of glamour here.
We do in this town.
There's a certain amount, but everything's, there's a humidity that sort of ruins the hair, you know, and it's just, there's a reason why Hollywood was Hollywood. I mean, it was, they went there because it was a beautiful day every day and the light feels manufactured. It's just so beautiful and so perfect. And so, you know, one of the things I thought about was just that the reputation of Hollywood or of Los Angeles or Southern California is of a kind of surface, right? And the East Coast, we're always like, yeah, they're shallow, right? And we're here suffering, you know.
We have to give meaning to our pain.
You have to suffer, right? That's that. I write about this in the essay, right? You always are saying, like, you have to suffer through the winter to really enjoy the spring. But when you get out there, you realize that that is just a lie. That you can feel good every day. And there's a reason why, despite all of the problems of plaguing the place, it's in a desert, there's no water, there's huge inequality, it's incredibly overpriced and expensive, it's filled with an industry that glorifies terrible things about body image, there's terrible race issues and the police, but people seem to be kind of happy and they kind of feel good and they seem kind of at ease in a way that we don't. And I think that has to do with, the weather. And then the point of this is that this idea of glamour started to come to me, right? So you know, grammar in Middle English meant grammary with a Y-E, and then meant magic. And so the way that you articulate yourself, like spelling is similar, right? Like a spell is how you put words in a certain order. That's how you make magic. And, you know, I realized that there's this kind of intense magic just coming off of, bouncing off of every surface, just the worst kind of stucco on the edge of a strip mall. It just looks like, you know, an ad for a cake in a magazine. Like, it's just delicious. And then, you know, I kind of go to the idea that the camera is a thing that only sees surfaces. It doesn't get inside. And it luxuriates in the surfaces of things. And so, you know, that's what the book is about on some level. It's about a lot of other things, too. But that's one thing it's about.
Luxuriating in the surfaces.
Yeah.
But then what is this idea of I'm looking through you? I mean, obviously, a camera, but the subjects, or the opacity of your subjects, I should say, the pictures in here are some of your best work I've seen.
They are my best work so far.
Well, I haven't seen all of your work, I'm hedging. There's portraits in here. There's portraits. There's landscapes. There's cityscapes. There's stuff that was sort of posed and unposed, and all of the images are interesting. I like the ones that are striking, and even the ones that aren't immediately striking, they always require your attention. That's what I really enjoy about looking at your work, is that it's the details, it's the things that you just have, you put in that frame, and because I trust you, you know, with this, I'm looking for the connections. You know, and sometimes there's humor, sometimes it's poignant, sometimes it's both. Even though you're taking the surfaces, you're still trying. You're still penetrating.
Yeah, I think the idea is that it's by the surfaces that we understand the world, right? Like, we don't really know about the interiors of people, right? There's that. It's like that Groucho Marx line.
Outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend.
Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. And that idea, you know, I think that one of the things that photography has taught us is that the way that you read the surfaces of the world is incredibly complicated. That photographs lack that very simple cognition that language brings, right? So I can just go, you know, my mouth is dry. And I can articulate exactly, you know, how I feel. But in a photograph, you can't do that. You have to do it through some other means, the surfaces of a person's face or their body or their position in space or their connection to something else. And you know, we've grown incredibly articulate at that kind of reading, and yet the thing about a photograph is that because it can't go X equals X, those meanings are super open-ended. Anyone could read them differently. And so to me, there's a kind of like charge that I'm looking for. Like if it's charged up enough, like, right? So if you get, you know, rub a balloon, then the particles start to get charged all over the place and it makes the balloon stick to the wall. I'm going to mix metaphors probably here. But in the same way that if a photograph has enough charge, enough intentionality, anybody could look at it and read it in all kinds of different ways and would want to. And I still maintain that there's something about this. And I was thinking today about a photograph as being this very strange, like, sort of plane, right? Like, life is going around four-dimensionally all around us. And we're going to select a rectangle of it, a two-dimensional amount of it, made from one vantage point. And we're going to say, this is important. And it's so simple, right? Like, press a button and you're pretty much done, made art. It's ridiculous, right? My wife is a painter and she calls me a button pusher. You're just a button pusher. And
but certainly there's something that separates your average button pusher and a professional button pusher.
I am a professional button pusher in more ways than one. But I mean, I think there's something, and it's that ability to generate that charge, right? It's the ability to, like, charge the particles enough so that you can smash the atom and see the strange particles inside.
But it seems like from your essays, and this was very autobiographical. The book was very autobiographical. I mean, a separate from the pictures, but the essays. And you write about a girlfriend's mother or grandmother that you had.
Grandmother
who reminded you of Audrey Hepburn. And
she had been a model or Catherine in the 50s.
Hepburn. Yeah. And you were running around saying, look at this, look at this, look at this, look at this. And she called you
She called me Mr. Hey, look at this. Hey, look at that. And it was super flirty, you know, I thought, at the time. And she had been a model. She was, like, gorgeous.
Right.
You know, she was, I mean, how? Not. She must have been, like, 60 or something at that time. But it seemed like she was a million years old. Yeah.
So you always have had that.
I've always had that. I got into photography when I was, you know, 7 or 8, and my father had a little dark room in our off of our kitchen in Saratoga, and he would develop, you know, pictures in there, and he I think he had really gotten into it in Malawi where I was born, and he and my mother were in the Peace Corps, and, you know, so I remember distinctly the very first time I went out to take pictures, and one thing I remember about it was that I expected them to be black and white, but the film was in color, and when I got them back, I was all kind of, like, disturbed that they were in color. I didn't understand. I was like, oh, no, you know, I hadn't thought about them being in color.
Hmm.
And, I mean, I think that it always has given me, this feeling of affirmation, that the ability to make used to be whatever, a roll of 36 pictures, mm-hmm. and now it's an infinite amount that you mm-hmm. can take. Be able to make a good one and then another good one, it's really just like this kind of endless kind of affirmation. And in I don't remember if it's in this book. No, it's in my. It's in another book that I did this year, of my show, a big show I had at the Tang Museum at Skidmore 2 years ago now. But I talk about the camera as being like this friend who always wants to do what you want to do, and who never judges you, and who will go with you anywhere you want to go. If you decide, in the essay I say, if you decide you want to like cut school and walk down the train tracks, it'll go. And then, you know, you actually take this thing into a dark room and kind of reach inside of it, and you have this super intimate relationship that's physical, but it's more than that. There's this feeling that, I mean, I can't think of another relationship I have in my life other than with my camera that's this non-judgmental and that I get along with as well.
You get along with some cameras better than others?
Well, that's a part of the story of this book, too, is that I've always used an analog film camera, a big, heavy one on a tripod, a view camera, and this... Part of the story of this book was that I've always had a job since I've been 14. I've always had a job. And I grew up without any money or anything, and I always worked. And suddenly I found myself on sabbatical from teaching and not having a job. And I, not only that, I'm in Los Angeles, and it's Christmas. It's beautiful. You know, I've left this... cold, nasty.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of an accident that you wound up in L.A., though, wasn't it? I mean, you went to photograph sunset strips at strip malls at sunset.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just didn't seem like it was happening. It wasn't clicking. You know, there's a moment.
It was failing.
It was failing, and your wife, really kind of gave you that push.
Yeah, she said, you got to do something that's going to make you happy. Because I was spending, this is an accident. It's sort of, this is an explanation in a way of how a photographic project gets made. Which, what happens is that, let's say you live in the Hudson Valley, where the sunsets are spectacular. And there's a mall near you in Kingston, say, that's built on top of a giant beautiful escarpment on an old dairy farm, and from which you can see out to the west those beautiful Hudson Valley sunsets. And I happened to make this picture of, you know, the beautiful Thomas Cole kind of sunset, but there's just like beer world and there's some coyotes out there. We might pick up some coyotes. Actual fear of an actual coyote,
yes.
And then I thought, oh, I should make a whole bunch of these, right? And this is where, like, you know, photography has a kind of addictive quality too. It's like you just want more and more and more. And you know, I made a bunch more, but I also would spend all day kind of looking for a location, and then I would figure they're all from elevated. They're called sunset strips, and they're like from elevated perspectives, looking out at strip malls at sunset. It's like an excuse to make a sunset picture. Mm. I never felt like, okay, you know, it's too cheesy or whatever. So, you put a strip mall in it, then it's okay, right?
Then
you inoculate it yourself.
What you inoculate with what irony, tension?
Yeah, both all those things. Yeah. And, I mean, you know, I always. I'm like, these stories are cascading one into another, but, you know, as a kid, I would climb up this hill in Amherst, it's a drumlin called Mount Pollux, and with my friend, and it we would look out at the valley, the Pioneer Valley, and everyone would go like, wow, look at the stars, man, and I always remember being like, yeah, but down in the valley there where the mall is and everything, like, it's much more beautiful, obviously. Like, the stars are beautiful, but it's only because we know I mean, from a purely aesthetic point of view, like, they got nothing on a strip mall, like, just lights and colors. And they're nothing. Like, they're these faded
the
things.
The stars got nothing on a strip mall.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, you have to know that the stars are special in order to like the stars better than that, right? Anybody who didn't know, like a child, a baby.
Right. Well, I tell you what, Amazon's not putting the stars out of business.
At any rate, those pictures were hard to make because I would spend all day looking for a location, and then it would. The sunset doesn't always happen. Sometimes it happens in the east. I've witnessed it many times. The sunset can happen in the east instead of the west. If the clouds are over in the east and there's no cloud, you have to have clouds to have a sunset. You have to have some kind of moisture in the air. And if there's no clouds in the west, but there are in the east, that part in the east will turn pink sometimes. And so I would spend all day, and I would, so when I knew I was having this time, and we decided to go to L.A., and partially that's just family stuff, and I love it there, that's when I kind of realized I needed something broader, something that could, and yeah.
So you just roamed L.A. with your camera.
Yeah, on foot.
On foot. It's not a real walking town.
It's a great walking city.
Is it?
Yeah, big wide sidewalks everywhere, and nobody on them.
Hmm.
You know, you have to, and L.A. is a series of, I forget how many villages, but it's like 22 villages that have just smushed together.
Mm-hmm.
So to get from one village to the other, you always have to kind of like go through a passage of Dante of an underpass with incredible like homelessness and, you know, mental health issue craziness. But if you walk under that, if you make it through that underpass, and I never had any trouble, and I always found it fascinating and interesting under there, too.
Mm.
Hard to photograph because it's dark, and I didn't really want to photograph it. But you come out on the other side, and you're in, like, another village.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone. I can see all
So I suppose we should talk about some of the pictures.
Yeah.
You got a lot of pictures in this book.
Yes, there's 155, I believe.
And like I said earlier, there's portraits, there's landscapes, there's cityscapes.
There's significant details.
Tremendous details. And some of them are just...
You could like randomly... I've been doing these things, little essays where I randomly open the book. Not essays, but little videos where I randomly open it and just start talking. But you could also
You mind if I do that?
No, I'm
excited. But first off, I've noticed there were no titles or anything.
No.
They were just sort of organized with the sort of thematically this broad sections.
Yeah.
Was there any thought behind not giving them titles? Titles?
I think of this as a work of fiction in a lot of ways. Mm. Even though all, you know, the pictures are almost entirely discovered and in situ. There's a part in the book where I talk about feeling like I'm a medieval photographer.
Mm-hmm.
In that, there's a lot of things about my work. And as I was making this work, I started to realize this, that it just didn't look realistic to me.
Hmm.
That I was kind of dealing with, like, in a way that before the Renaissance. They haven't quite figured out perspective, right? And they're not necessarily interested in realism at all. They're interested in some kind of spiritual, essential thing. And that I realized that, say, the pictures of people, I felt more like saints to me than they did like individuals. Mm. And I still think of them that way. Like some of the pictures are, when I title them, they're, like there's one called the patron saint of being stoned. And I think of them as saints, the people in the book. Not necessarily as individuals. And there's all kinds of swirling complications around that. I mean, there could be lots to talk about that, about people and the way I'm representing them. I mean, my standard for photographing a person is to, in a portrait setting, very few of these are portraits, meaning that the person is aware that I'm photographing them. Many more of them, they're not aware. But in that kind of setting, my standard is always to try to show something about them that they don't know about.
Mm.
Right? Or that's one of my standards.
Right. So let's start with this first one.
Yeah.
This one just completely pops.
Yeah. Yeah, this one is of a woman against this strange yellow space, which is actually like a kind of public marketplace in downtown LA. And she's got this incredibly long hair that goes down to her ankles. And she's got this red dress on, and she's probably, I don't know, how old is she, 65 or something?
Could be in her 60s, could be, yeah, in her 70s.
And she's super beautiful, mm-hmm, just elegant, and, one of the things I think that I've always, I am not like a magical photographer of people, a portrait photographer, and I want to clarify this by, I know this from teaching, that you just get somebody every once in a while who can point the camera right at your face in the most simple way and do that magical, gather something ineffable about you, gather something that no language could describe. And I don't naturally have that. Hmm. I'm a much more about gathering the whole picture and seeing something kind of social. I'm not maybe like that good with people in general. So I've had to develop other tactics. And my very first photographic project, which was made around here in the 80s, where I would meet people on the street, and I would set a photograph up, and then I would give them an object to look at. And there were lots of theoretical reasons why I did that, mm-hmm, at the time. But another part of it was kind of not wanting to have to engage with their eyes directly. And most of the people in this book are not looking into the camera. I don't know if anybody is really directly looking into the camera.
I didn't, nothing popped out.
Yeah, there's maybe one or two, but mostly they're not. And so one of the things that happened here was, now that I think about it, I'm not sure. There's a couple of people looking into the camera, but they have fake lenses, so it's like I'm hidden away. But you
have pictures of people looking into other cameras.
Yes, but let me finish with this.
This one, I think you're underselling just the.
Well, I'm getting to that. The strategy,
the beauty of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's a beautiful picture. I mean, it's just like the color and the form.
It's all about the color.
Are stunning, but what I kind of remember doing. Where I'm wandering around. It's a kind of a gray day. It's not like a classic LA bright day. And I'm having an okay day, but it's not going that great. And I just see this woman, and it's just, she's just a superhero, like, as you know, that there's just like the part of being a photographer that's like being a casting director, right? You kind of have to be all the jobs at the end of the credits of a movie, and the casting director's part was just boom, like just what an amazing character. And soulful and beautiful. And when you photograph someone who's aware that they're being photographed, you always have had to, but increasingly now you have to get through a kind of ability to pose.
Obviously, it's because of everybody's always being photographed all the time.
And they're photographing themselves.
Mm.
Like, I think that the invention, I think it was Nokia actually invented the front-facing camera on a phone, and like the first one was in like 2004 or something. I think it was the...
Is it that late? I guess it's been around for 16 years, 17 years.
Yeah, now. But actually most people didn't have it until much later than that. It's the greatest, possibly the greatest invention in the history of narcissism. Right? Like, just, there's been a few other things, like sort of Freud. That's like a big thing where people are really like, ooh, I'm important. My inner life is important. Mm-hmm.
Karaoke.
Another one. And so you have to kind of break it down, and it's so, it can be impossible. Mm-hmm. There's people
that are
unbreakable.
But what are some of your strategies? Well, for breaking people down,
I've got the old, like, pretend that you just swallowed a cherry stone. Sometimes you say that, people, like, they swallow and they go into their bodies and they lose awareness of you. I love to have people talking to somebody else. I'll say, just, can you keep talking to that person? And then they engage and then they lose self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, in this case, I remember employing another strategy, which was just to wait. And I'm just watching her. I'm just sitting and watching her.
You've talked to her, obviously.
I've talked to her, mm-hmm. and, you know, chatted with her for a while, and I asked if I could take a picture. The percentage of people in L.A. that allow you to take their picture is like 70% compared to the rest of the world is like 30%. Hmm. Because everyone in LA is like just about to break it big, you know. There's no reality there. I don't think that like reality is it's very secondary to some imaginative space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people are really imaginative there, and they really feel like they're living in a story. There's another picture of a guy in this book who was kind of running this kind of scam, this like gambling scam.
And what was it called?
I forget what it's called. I wrote about it and now I can't remember. But, you know, and he was just this guy way out in the valley in a really crummy gas station. And he was just, and meanwhile, while he's waiting for people to come do this gambling scam, he's like coloring a coloring book that says "Believe" with swirly letters. I mean, the guy's like my age, and he's coloring with colored pencils in a coloring book. And then when I talk to him, he's just like, "I'm going to open up a chain of topless drive-ins." Like, everyone's got a dream there. But in this case, you know, I just sat and watched this woman with the long hair and the red dress and the red shoes against the yellow background. And I just waited, and eventually she just grew unstiff, and she put one foot back, and she started thinking about something, and boom, that was it. And I think I only took one frame,
really?
Which I'm used to doing from using an analog camera, so I don't shoot a lot of pictures, usually, of each situation.
You feel like you get more of a rush than with a digital?
I'm totally in love with this, you know, with the digital camera, but I know that I've earned this. Like, I've earned this. This is just like, I've been pumping iron all my life, and now I'm just like being handed a feather, and I'm like, yeah, I got this feather. Whereas most people picking up a feather is, it's really hard to control a feather. It's really hard to, right? It's just this, so I just treat this thing like it's a view camera. And, you know, that kind of helps me. But
yeah, so, yeah, magnificent picture. If that had been painted, it's almost a painting.
Yeah,
I mean, if that had been painted, I think people would be like, ah, it's complete fabrication. But boom, there it is.
Well, and the way the background looks with these weird receding lines of all of yellow, I mean, these medieval artists that I'm interested in, like Fra Angelico, who didn't understand space in a kind of normal way, you know, this would just look like, this would be very easy to kind of squint and imagine it, you know, in the Vatican Museum in an early in the 13th century, like before they had quite kind of figured out. Part of that is a technical thing. Like I'm shooting with a longer lens than I ever used to use, and mostly, and so the space gets kind of flattened out. And, you know, basically I tried to do everything differently than I'd ever done. Like, I just decided to kind of flip it all on its head and do all the things that I never did, including lots of things that I told, you know, students not to do for years.
Such as?
Well, you know, I'm using, like, a long aspect ratio that I never liked. It's a 35-millimeter aspect ratio, which is longer and skinnier than a 4x5 aspect ratio, which is more square, the one I'd always used and I always just felt was perfect. All the pictures are verticals, and I never had done many verticals, and I certainly had never used that long aspect ratio. And, you know, I'm walking, I'm using a digital camera, I don't have like a tight conceptual framework exactly the way I've always required of students, really. Mm-hmm. Not always, but I've encouraged to have a kind of like, know what you're doing thing. And I've usually had that too. And I just was like, I'm throwing all of it out and starting again. And, you know, I think that's kind of the reason why the book is really fresh and really...
I was going to say, not that your old stuff is stale, but there's definitely a vitality to a lot of the pictures in this book that...
It's amazing. I mean, just when I close my eyes and remember the time when my job was to get up and wander around Los Angeles all day.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the best. I mean, it's just like,
yeah.
I sign me up. If that's my circle of hell, I'll stay there forever. Yeah.
I'm looking through you. Where did you go? I thought I knew you. What did I know?
So I noticed a lot of the pictures just on one page, blank page opposite, but then several sets that are set up like diptychs.
Yeah, we call them spreads.
Okay, so I'm medieval
world.
And I like, again, it's worth taking your time and just kind of sitting and looking at the pictures and there's a conversation between the pictures on either side of what you call a spread. And you've opened up to one. I love this one. I was like, ooh, an idolater, you know. Could you talk about these two pictures that you opened up to?
Yeah, one of them on the left side is a close-up of the sort of nose, mouth, neck area of a woman, and she's wearing a gold necklace that says Ego. This was the day of the women's march, and we were in a big hotel downtown. Our friends from Mika and Mila were there in that hotel, and they came with us to the women's march. And I just thought it was like this Buddhist kind of joke, right? It was amazing, like your ego, and in a place where, you know, where it's famous for its egos. And she's beautiful, and she's also probably in her 60s and has all kinds of dyed hair and braids and a feather tied into her hair. She's really done up. And it's this kind of close-up detail of this light glowing off this gold necklace. And on the other side is of a person, a woman in Venice Beach, who's a homeless person, but she's like in front of this synagogue, and then she's just wrapped in all these amazing kind of cloths and surrounded, and she's holding up a snake, and it's just like Egypt. It just is just she's in profile.
Yeah,
it's just Egypt. You know what I mean? And you know, it was just as I started to think of these characters again, not as individual portraits of an actual person and their particular story and their particular identity, but as sort of like types, archetypes.
Sure.
And like in a Hollywood film, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like characters with big presences. You know, and here's Eve with a snake, and and it's kind of, you know, the way that you describe that there being sections, and you describe that there's sometimes an individual picture on one side, either left or the right, the verso or the recto. Yeah, that's the left and right side of a book page. The left one is the verso, and the right one is the recto.
Oh, I did not know that.
Is
that just in photography, or all books?
I learned that in regular book publishing when I worked at New Directions. But this book was made, you know, came about in an interesting way, which was that I also decided to do a new thing, which was called Instagram. And I hated Instagram. I still hate it. And it just seemed like the worst thing in the world, right? To just like vomit up and cast a cascade of everything you ever did. And they were photographs, they were going to be tiny, right? So it was going to reduce the subtlety and complexity. But I was just like, I'm doing everything different. And I started putting them up, and someone from Aperture said, so what is this work, you know? And that started a conversation about the book. Then it took 3 years to put it in an order and design it.
Mm.
And so in that 3 years, you know, right, so one of the things about social media is that there's this instant publication. Like you do something and you publish it instantly.
Mm.
And, I mean, that is just not a good way to do anything good, right? The part where you gestate what you've done and you cook it, right? It's just like everything's just raw meat. And you know, it's just like a big...
Some of it's still squirming.
Yeah, it's still squirming. And I mean, and that's got its own fascinating thing. But the part of being an artist,
yeah,
say, or a writer, where you take what you've done in a spontaneous way and then shape it, you know, it's just vital. And it's so important and so much of, I mean, if there had been like Facebook, you know, who knows what would have like Don Quixote have looked like, you know what I mean? Like it's already got a lot of crazy stuff in it, but it would have been like 10,000 pages long of random whatever. I mean, it's just, so the book took a long time to edit and sequence, and it had many iterations, and it was difficult. I mean, it was like started out with like 500 little tiny prints and just like laying them out and trying to figure out what it was about.
Mm-hmm. So when you're doing the layout, when you're looking at pictures and you're choosing pictures to put in the book, do you have a couple that you're like, ooh, these need to be on the recto and the verso?
Definitely. There are pairs of pictures.
There are pairs that you're like,
in fact,
ooh.
That's exactly
Or do
how
you
we
have
did
a
it.
Picture and then go hunting for another picture that will speak to it or engage it in a sort of visual conversation?
The way we did it with Leslie Martin and Andrew Sloat, who are the designer, the editor and the designer of the book, was we would get together in a big room at Aperture in New York, and we had all these prints, and everybody would just start making these pairs. Mm. And at first, Leslie really wanted it to be all, every page, inch of it filled up, and super maximalist. And I had to cut, in the end, it was like, it's already a lot. Like, the book is a lot.
I think that's a good, that was a good decision, because it would have been too much.
Yeah.
And sometimes, if you have a blank page opposite a photograph, it kind of gives you license to dwell on that photograph a little bit longer.
And because the pictures are funny, and because they're emotional and intense and clever, it was really tempting to make little pairings that were clever and funny. Mm. And there are plenty of those, and I'm ashamed of it at all. Like, subtlety is not my strong suit, and I want the book to be very entertaining, which I think it is. And, but, you know, in the end, it came down to a kind of rhythm. And finally, like, after really having it kind of down, I just one night sat in my studio and I started listening to noir soundtracks of California noir films, like Chinatown and LA Confidential and other ones that have great soundtracks. And I just started re-editing the entire thing. And I just started with page one, and then I just started thinking about how page one would talk to page two. And I, even in the case of like things that are like sight lines, like in movies, right? Mm-hmm. Where, so like I started thinking about like this woman, the yellow background with the red dress, and she's looking here.
Mm-hmm. The color sort of carries thematically into the next picture.
Yeah, and even people's eye lines are kind of like played out. And then I re-edited the entire thing, which caused the whole thing to take an extra year or so, probably. Mm-hmm. But as a kind of noir, like I think of it as a kind of like L.A. noir film with, you know, a kind of intensity, and there is a kind of like emotional sadness, I think, under a lot of it, even if it's beautiful and sexy and glamorous.
Yeah, no, there's a lot. I agree. There's a lot in every shot.
There's a lot in every shot.
Do you think this is more autobiographical than other books?
Oh, yeah, that you've read? And it's interesting that you say that you've heard them before, because part of the whole way that I'm writing now came about because of this porch, this storytelling thing. Mm. And so I was asked to do a storytelling evening at the porch, which was like the moth that we have up here. You've done it many times. And you know, I noticed that all my stories were about taking pictures. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to something we talked about earlier, but I didn't get to sort of get too into, which is like sort of the idea that you're like taking this quick little sort of 120th of a second of the world. It's flat, two-dimensional, a kind of core sample of the universe. And it's like weirdly, stupidly kind of evident, right? It's just like, oh yeah, okay, right. Like I can know what a picture is of very easily. Like, I don't think there's any pictures in here. Maybe mm-hmm. one or two, you mm-hmm. can't tell immediately what they're of.
Right.
But what they mean mm-hmm. is very complicated and unknowable on some level. And so I'm really interested in the idea that a photograph is a thing that can generate talk, can generate a story, it can generate ideas.
Yeah, every story tells a picture.
Every story tells a picture. But you know, it isn't easy, right? I teach photography, and I notice that students, it takes them a while to kind of learn how to talk about a picture. And I, when I was asked to do a storytelling evening, and I noticed that all my stories were about the act of taking pictures, that I was out in the world, right? So the old sort of dilemma of theater, like how do you get two people in a room talking to each other? Well, I spent all my time wandering around in the world, so I have experiences. And I have all kinds of weird and bizarre experiences all the time. And to kind of get them into like 8 minutes or 6 minutes was kind of hard. And so that when I went to LA, I also started the process of writing essays with the notion that eventually I want to publish an autobiography, a memoir of a life in photography through photographs, but mostly it's going to be writing and a kind of compilation of these stories, and knowing that I didn't have to keep them to 6 minutes in length.
I think your complaint with the sort of social media and the lack of editing and the lack of crafting, you know, forcing your story to 6 to 8 minutes, I found always was valuable exercise.
Sure. I just think that what I like about these essays is that if the idea of you're looking at a flat thing that's going to generate, you know, employ all of your knowledge, all of your awareness, all of your feelings, right? I mean, the other thing is, like, I've just started to write much more about emotion. And I think of these essays, especially the one that's called Bar Fight as Artist Statement, like, have a lot of emotion in them. They're, like, really, they're about my feelings. And so that was a practice that kind of went alongside this. Like, I would get up every morning before my family woke up and write, and then I would go out and take pictures all day, and then I would fall asleep putting my son to bed at 9 o'clock, and then I would sort of wake up at 5 and have time to write in the morning.
Sounds idyllic.
It was idyllic. It's great. I need to get back to it. So it is really autobiographical. And I once wrote, you know, I write a lot of essays for other people's art books. And I once began one, no one reads the essays in art books. And you're probably not reading this right now, was the second line. And the reality is that almost all writing about art is impossible to read.
It's awful.
It's
awful. It's opaque. It's jargony.
But
your writing, I was going to say, your writing is very different, and that's what makes it such an engaging book. I wish there was more essays in it. I wish there was more essays.
Yeah. Well, those essays are coming. They're coming in another book eventually. Yeah.
Mom, buy this book. You know,
they have it, a signed copy of it at Oblong.
They have signed. Are you going to be giving readings?
I'm trying. Yes, they're going to be. I mean, I don't know yet. Actually, on the 26th of June, there's going to be a Zoom book launch, which Aperture will be hosting. I have a good performance for this book. I haven't. What isn't a normal slide talk either, right? Like, just as art writing can be really bad, slide talks can be really deadening. And the thing about photography is, even though I can wander around with a digital camera and take pictures all day, if I'm going to walk for 8 or 9 hours, there's going to be time when I'm not taking pictures. And so I started writing songs during that time.
Nice.
Would you like to hear one? It's raining reflectors down on Sunset Boulevard, and the sea stands two knee bends in the dark. And the models suck on bottles of the finest light on earth, while flashes spark.